I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I am very excited to welcome journalist and author Elise Hugh. Elise's book is called Flawless: Lessons in Looks and Culture from the K-Beauty Capital, and the book dissects the beauty industry, the influence, and the technological gaze. It is a book that is chock full of the kind of deep reporting about history, culture, and of course, beauty products that I love. Elise is also the host of the TED Talks Daily podcast and was a reporter at NPR for almost a decade. Today, Elise and I talk about Korean exports and soft power, the uptick of tweens in beauty culture, and the one book that Elise cannot stop talking about. Make sure to come back and listen to this show on Wednesday, March 27th, because Elise will be back to discuss our book club pick, Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. Everything we talk about on each episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. If you like what you hear today, consider joining The Stacks Pack, which is our community for book lovers. You can find it at patreon.com/thestacks. And by joining, you make it possible for me to make this independent podcast every single week. You also get perks for yourself. You get things like our monthly virtual book club. You get access to our Discord community. You get bonus episodes, and you get a little shout out on the show. It's only $5 a month. So if that sounds like something you'd be into, I would love that. Go to patreon.com/thestacks and join. Here's a shout out to some of our newest members of the Stacks Pack: Kemi Mustafa, Melissa Bethel, Dwayne Wilson, Catswell, Cheryl Shuckle, Laura, Kristen Kirchel, Elle, Megan McCray, and Angela Stallcup. Thank you all so much for joining the Stacks Pack, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. I couldn't do it without you. All right, now it is time for my conversation with Elise Hugh. All right, everybody, I am thrilled. It is March. I am joined today by Elise Hugh. She is the author of Flawless: Lessons in Looks and Culture from the K-Beauty Capital. Elise is also the host of TED Talk Daily.
Did TED Talks right? Daily.
Yep, TED Talks Daily, plural. I always
fuck it up. You made
it
singular, but there are more than one TED Talk.
There's actually many TED Talks that I can't believe I did that. Anyways, that voice you just heard is Elise. Welcome to The Stacks.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight.
I'm so thrilled to have you. Okay, we're going to start where we sort of always start, which is just generally, that's not your book or your work. Tell the people a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? What are you into? What's your shit?
Yeah, I claim Texas. I was born in St. Louis, but I really claim Texas because those are the roads that I know because I learned how to drive there. And the formative years of my life, I spent in Dallas, Texas. I am the daughter of immigrants. My father defected from China. He actually swam through a Bay of Sharks to freedom in Hong Kong during the Cultural Revolution, which probably should be a book of its own. My mother is from Taiwan. I now live in Los Angeles and am the mom to three girls in elementary school. So I spend a lot of my days doing a lot of hair.
Oh my gosh. I have two boys and my life is hell because my kids are very young and they're boys, but I think you're heading to a place that I would be very scared of, which is girls going to middle school eventually.
Tweendom.
Yeah. How do you feel about
that? It's already rough. Yes. It's already rough because I wrote a book that's sort of critiquing beauty culture, and yet I have a skincare girly in my home. Who wants a lot of skincare products?
Well, you just wrote that piece about like tweens being into beauty.
Yes, and my 11-year-old is one of them.
Oh my God.
Which is, you know, the ironies that show up in our lives.
Okay, before we get to the book, I want to backtrack a little bit in your life because I know the book came out of you being sent by NPR to be a bureau chief in Asia, based in Korea, focusing on like Korea and Japan. Can you just tell me what a bureau chief is? Because I don't actually know.
Sure. So if there are more than one, if there is more than one reporter in the bureau chief is responsible for a lot of the administrative tasks of an outpost. This term actually comes from the CIA or the Foreign Service. I can't remember which one. Mm. But the CIA has station chiefs. And so when you are posted abroad and headquarters is in the United States, then that office is in charge of kind of securing visas and making sure that the local staff is paid and considering security needs for all of the employees. I was bureau chief and correspondent in one. There was really only one local producer who worked with me, who was kind of my right arm, and I had a different one each year and also served as a translator. So something I failed to mention in my intro, which I guess is pretty important, is that I'm a journalist. I'm a working journalist, and I have been for my entire adult life. And my posting in South Korea came at the beginning of 2015 when I had just had a toddler, and then I had an elderly beagle, two elderly cats, and was 5 months pregnant and moved abroad. To sounds a place like I had never lived before, because as I mentioned, my people are Chinese. There are some overlaps with Korean culture, but I basically had to learn it from scratch. And I was responsible for covering North Korea, South Korea, and Japan.
And that was a time while you were there that North Korea and America were being very newsy.
Like super newsy.
You were there for like Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, like, are going to be friends, but maybe they're going to start a war. Like
it was
tune
both.
In to
you
find
know, it's
out.
A roller coaster because these were the early years of the Trump administration. And right. Donald Trump originally came in saying things like my nuclear button is bigger than yours.
Right. So iconic.
Kim Jong-un then had to respond, and both of them are kind of bloviating and autocratic. And so there were similarities as well. And Donald Trump actually was very in favor towards the end, and maybe this was just to burnish his image, but of being the first head of state to meet with the North Korean head of state. So towards the end of my stint in South Korea was the Kim Jong-un Donald Trump summit in Singapore, which right. didn't really achieve that much substantively. And since then, it's been largely walked back. But it was a huge photo op for both those guys. Both
and it
those
was
guys
like a
with
very
giant global
time.
Brands. Yeah, say what you want about the despot Kim Jong-un. He has a huge global brand.
Yeah, he does. He definitely does. Okay, so you're there, you're reporting. You're not there to report on beauty, but you fall into beauty land. Do you write, like, are you reporting and thinking, like, I'm going to turn this stuff into a book? Or are you just like, I'm super curious, I want to go to a baby spa?
I absolutely never wanted to write a book. I had no aspirations to write a book. In fact, there were so many other journalists that have written books that would come through South Korea, like Evan Osnos and Anna Fifield was one of my colleagues. And they're both like big nonfiction. They're writers of big nonfiction books. And they would be talking about kind of getting up at 5 a.m. and working on their pages and all these things. And I was like, I'm never going to write a book.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't have the discipline nor the interest and nothing that I am not curious about anything enough to devote that much time and energy and research to. So I had no designs on writing it. It wasn't until after I got back to the States that I really lamented the fact that there wasn't a book that tied a lot of the elements of gender disparity and beauty culture and the rise of Korean pop culture around the world together into one book. And I only wrote it because it didn't exist and I wanted it to exist and nobody else seemed to be doing it. So that's how Flawless came to be.
Did you have to go back then to do more research?
I did, but COVID happened. So the deal, I'm sure that you've talked to lots of authors about this process and you, Tracy, are very familiar with it. But when you are shopping around a book proposal, you often meet in person with the prospective buyers, the prospective publishing houses that are interested in it. And so the day I was going around New York with my book agent to meet with various editors was the last day New York was open before Broadway shut down. It was like Wednesday, March 11th or something, 2020. And my meeting with Dutton, who ended up acquiring the book, was the very last in-person meeting in the PRH headquarters. Before that office, everybody was sent home at 1 p.m. and my meeting was at 11 a.m. And that was the last meeting at PRH HQ until the building reopened after numerous rounds of virus. So it was rather dramatic how things happened, which meant the deal wasn't done until we were all in a serious and uncertain lockdown. So I didn't know when I could get back to Korea. And Korea had lots of quarantine protocols that meant if you were to go to Korea somehow, the government had to okay you for a quarantine exemption so that you wouldn't have to wait 14 days in a hotel room or 21 days sometimes in a hotel room before you could be released into the streets. Yeah.
Like such a crazy time. I feel like maybe because I've been reading a lot of books recently that have been set sort of like in the present, but don't deal with COVID, that sometimes I like forget about COVID when I'm talking about books like that have come out recently. Like I'm like, of course, yes, this is a nonfiction book. So you had to do all your research and it couldn't have been done that quickly. That's insane, actually.
We kind of memory hold it or tried to black it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, I don't want to talk about it anymore. For 3 years, I feel like it was all we talked about and it's like still going on. But I understand why everybody pretends like it's not, because it's like we don't want to talk about this anymore. But what I do want to talk about is Korean soft power.
Yeah.
So the book is about your exploration of beauty and beauty standards in Korea. But you sort of start the book in this place where you're like, why is this happening here? And one of the reasons is this like Korean soft power play, like through pop culture. I mean, you should explain it because I know that you know how better than I can.
Okay. So South Korea's economy has always had to be export driven because it is considered a shrimp between whales. It is a country that, or South Korea is one of the two Korean countries on the peninsula, but South Korea is sandwiched between China, one of the world's largest economies on the left, and then Japan, the world's third largest economy on the right. And so being a small resource poor nation with a population that is dwarfed by its neighbors, it really had to export in order to grow to be one of the top economies of the world. Originally, that was in heavy manufacturing. So South Korea was super, super poor following World War II and the Korean War, which really just destroyed the nation and all its resources and infrastructure. So it underwent under a dictator. It underwent this miracle on the Han, as it's called, which was massive manufacturing development. And it all happened in the 60s or 70s, and it operationalized South Korea, and it made itself into a manufacturing and export giant. So by the 90s, we were seeing a lot of Korean cars. We were seeing a lot of Korean electronics, Samsung, LG, Hyundai, Kia. So you know these brands.
Yeah.
Then the economy kind of dropped out again due to a banking crisis in 1997 called the Asian Financial Crisis. And South Korea had to get bailed out by the International Monetary Fund. And I know this sounds like a long way to go for a burger, but it's very important in that...
I will drive for a burger, don't worry.
Good. I'm really into those smash burgers lately, and I keep trying to make one.
I had one last night. Okay. Delicious.
Good. We really need to hang out because we don't live that far
this
away.
This is so LA.
I know. But I digress. So after this IMF bailout, South Korea needed to pay back its loans very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it needed to diversify its economy. And a government report in the late 90s found that if South Korea could make a blockbuster on the scale of Jurassic Park in the U.S., that the impact, the economic impact to South Korea's economy would be on the scale of manufacturing 2 million cars.
What?
So they were like, oh, man, we really need to invest in culture and try to drive some sort of blockbuster or big music or big content exports in order to diversify our economy. So at first it was like this economic gambit, and the government would pour money into film festivals and theaters and support studios, fledgling studios at the time, in order to make K-drama and K-film. And all of that did get going around the turn of the century, such that Korean dramas started getting really popular in Japan and then regionally in China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, eventually Southeast Asia. Then you saw K-pop really become more manufactured as what's called cultural technology. So thinking of the exporting of culture like we think about technological devices and tools, like really analyzing the data and the right shade of eyeshadow and the right triangle formations on stage and the right moment to introduce foreign producers and bring them into the music writing process. So all of that got really mechanized after the turn of the century. And we saw huge success, and we're continuing to see the success of that to this day with K-film, K-drama, K-pop, largest musical acts in the world, and BTS and Blackpink. We're seeing Oscar-winning films, Parasite, Minari. 6 out of 10 Netflix subscribers in the world have consumed Korean content. Probably Squid Game, but also likely to have included K-dramas. So I was really interested in this big pop culture juggernaut that we have seen transmit images of beautiful Koreans across the world. And you don't transmit all these images of beautiful Koreans without also transmitting their ideals and what it means to be beautiful and popular in that region. And that meant Southeast Asia in particular began really chasing Korean beauty standards. And then Korea as itself, domestically, really began to wear its beauty products and procedures and ideals and surgery as a matter of pride. Like, this is part of our business. This is part of selling the nation. And all of these things are tangled together and written about in Flawless.
Right. I don't know if you've talked about this, and I don't know if this is real, but a lot of the book, you know, because it's so focused on women, there are sections later on that talk about children and men, but so much of the book is focused on the female beauty standard. And, you know, it's the skincare, it's the legs, it's like all of these things. And because, you know, we know that South Korea is focused on exporting these beauty products and this beauty standard, we know that they're investing time and money and like brain power in thinking about women and their faces and their bodies and their skin. So I'm wondering if you've seen anything in like a pro-feminist lens about this stuff, because I feel like in America, when I think about the industries that were like the most gung-ho behind, they're really geared towards men, right? Like even Hollywood, like the blockbuster films are the like superhero movies for men. And like, yes, there's women. And like, yes, Zendaya is in Dune, but like it's geared towards men. Mm-hmm, and like, we are so anti-woman here. So I'm wondering, with one of their biggest exports being geared towards women, is there any sort of like, yay woman. Because some of it is really ick, like the body, like the diet culture, which is also very ick here.
Right.
But like some of it is like very upsetting. But I'm just wondering if there's any like they've tapped into a girl vibe.
One thing that I think about in particular is the way that K-pop tends to be engineered toward the female gaze. So instead of playing or assuming that the audience is male, most of the K-pop audience is woman or woman identifying. And as a result, you have men who are considered soft boys or flower boys, as I write about in the chapter about men. Right. And so they kind of subvert traditional tropes of masculinity as being super macho and hairy. In fact, I mean, look at any of these K-pop boy groups that have like waxed faces. They wax their facial hair instead of shave it in order to make sure that they do not have stubble. Korean K-pop idol men pay a lot of attention to their hair and their brows and their grooming in general, their skin. And so I like the subversion of traditional tropes of masculinity. I like the idea of playing to a female gaze instead of a male gaze, since we're all so tired of that. And I do think it's exciting as an Asian American to see Asian ideals be emulated here in the West. I think it's cool because growing up, I always felt like I didn't fit in and that I had to try to earn my status among my white peers, being in St. Louis and then suburban Texas. And here, my kids are growing up, obviously, in Los Angeles, which is a lot more diverse. But my kids are growing up chasing a lot of Korean beauty standards, which I like that sort of flip-flopping of ideals, which is cool. But at the same time, what is it all in service of? You know, and should we be buying all this stuff? And should 11-year-olds really need skincare routines? Those are deeper, high-level questions.
Right. I want to talk about, because some of the criticism I've heard of the book, which I can't really speak to because I'm not Asian, but it's come from Korean and Korean-American readers who have been like, well, she's not Korean. Like, she doesn't know the culture. She doesn't know the language. And I know also, like, in America, we are really good at lumping people together through like arbitrary, like Asian American contains from Japan to Korea to Thailand to Myanmar.
Right,
like it's so many different people and so many different cultures. And so I know that you're being an American going to Korea, there's got to be some like disconnect or difficulty of like feeling like you are representing this entire like America, but also being chosen or like being a representative as a person who's Asian, but not being Korean and then like writing this book. So I'm just wondering how you grapple with sort of all of those different intersections and like sort of the delicacies around all of that.
Yeah, I tried to be really sensitive about that. And I wrote a little bit in the intro about this idea of writing near because it isn't a culture of my own. And it is Korean culture is really distinct from Taiwanese American or Chinese American and American culture as well. So even a Korean American would face similar criticisms because there is such a distinction between Korean Americans and then native Koreans. And so I was fully expecting that and tried my best to just really center the voices of the people that I was talking to, the hundreds of Korean women in the book itself. And we should also remember that it is impossible, I think, to do any sort of journalism without a certain perspective. And so the best that I can do is sort of just be very transparent about the perspective that I'm coming from. In some ways, it's advantageous. I think in some ways, it's helpful to not be Korean and to write a book as an outsider because I do really have an outsider perspective. Right. In other ways, and then as somebody who sort of doesn't understand things, I can let my curiosities drive me in a way that if I could understand what was in between the lines, you know, then I think that I would have this assumed knowledge that might be difficult to translate onto the page. And so I tried to do my best, A, just acknowledging this is where I'm coming from, and then B, centering the voices of the women themselves. And then finally, I think with all of journalism, it's better if there is more representation. So so it would be great if there were more books on this topic and more in the discourse, period, because I shouldn't be the only one having to represent a book on like a nonfiction take on global beauty standards coming out of Korea. It should be many of us and then and all of these books kind of in conversation with one another. So I'm still hopeful about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I appreciated about your voice with this book is that you and I are both, from what I understand from the book, not like super into beauty stuff.
No.
And I actually like didn't really have a lot of interest in your book. Like I saw it a few times and then Brittany Luce was like, oh, I loved it. You have to read it. And she's the reason I picked it up because I was like, okay, I don't care about beauty. So like, I'm not going to care about this, but it's a lot more. I mean, the parts that I loved the most were the parts about like soft power and like things that were a little bit outside, like the business aspects of all of it. I really liked that because I don't know the difference between a serum and a cream or whatever.
Yeah, in fact,
I have no clue.
In fact, you know, the thing is I consider editing to be a love language and I would have gone back and forth like 17 more rounds to have this book be like 20% shorter because if I were to more rigorously edit or had that luxury, then I, like you, get kind of bored with various intricacies of serums and foundations. and that's as a journalist who covers beauty as a topic, right? And I think it's just, you know, a product of the way that we
well,
all have
I was glad it was in there. But I was glad that stuff was in there because it actually helped me to understand better. But going into it, I was like, oh, I'm not going to care about this. But because you were curious and you didn't know, I felt like there was a space for me in this book. Whereas if you had been like deep insider on beauty stuff, if you had been like a worker at Sephora, I would have been like, I can't do this. Like they're giving me way too many details about the creamy and the powder. And I don't care.
Yeah.
But okay, this is something that I really was curious about. And this was a part of the book that I really loved, which was about this question of like the white gaze and like, you know, there's a lot of Korean and I think has trickled through a lot of Asia beauty standards that have to do with like fair skin. And in the book, you talk about how that predates colonialization and like that it is that there's like this American obsession with like putting ourselves at the center of things. But my question is less about the white gaze and more about the anti-blackness that does show up that is not necessarily tied to wanting to be white or American or Western, but this hatred of like darkness. And I'm curious what that is about.
I think that kind of, I wish I knew. I wish I knew some sort of historical root to it, but across East Asia, sadly, I did see a lot of anti-blackness. And in some parts of Asia, of course, there is the history of colonization. I'm thinking Southeast Asia in particular. Some South Koreans would argue that they were occupied by Americans and American troops following the Korean War. So a few things tied to whiteness, I think that we cannot ignore, or this sort of whiteness standard, is that most of the whiteness standard in the world is as a result of oppressive forces like colonization.
Yes.
So the whiteness standard in India, the whiteness standard in Africa, all tied to colonization. And in Northeast Asia, it's a little bit different. It's remixed. So there are still, you know, forces that occupied Asia that probably did influence beauty standards and some of the whiteness standards. But what I get into is how they're far more ancient in some cases. They're thousands and thousands of years old, these whiteness standards that came out of class and wanting to be more aristocratic. But yeah, something that was really dismaying in my experience in South Korea was racism, you know, like the names of certain clubs, for example, the friends of mine that were black that ended up being American expats for the most part and what they described experiencing in South Korea. Mm. I also faced some bias, you know, as being a foreigner, but it was a different flavor than the anti-blackness.
Interesting. Okay. In the book, we get to talk about men and we get to talk about the youth. And you took your 8-month-old to a spa.
Oh, she was like 2 months.
Or sorry, 2 months, 8 weeks is what I meant to say. 8 weeks to get a baby facial, which is one of the wildest things I've ever heard. But I do know that there are lots of baby spas here in LA, or like kid spas, because a girlfriend of mine took her kid to a birthday party and it was a spa birthday party. Mm-hmm. And they did a full spa thing and like cucumbers and the whole thing, which is just blows my mind. But you just wrote a piece also about like tweens and beauty and how they're taking it in more. And I'm wondering if there's like anything if we think there's anything good about this obsession with like beauty culture, it's not new, but like the fact that it's trickling down younger and younger, like, is there anything that we should be excited about this? Or is this like sort of a warning, or is it neutral to you?
No, I think chasing algorithmically derived standards is a warning. It's something that could be very dangerous, because if we're trying to look like our filters, then we're allowing digital standards or AI-generated standards to dictate what we do to our physical bodies. And chasing artificial standards can only get more and more cyborgian, because by definition, they're artificial. So I do think that's worrying. I also think that chasing a certain internet-driven sameness is what's distinct about this generation and its skincare routines, and then our generation and our skincare routines. Because as I wrote in that piece for The Atlantic that you're talking about, it's not as if we were spared being marketed personal care products that were largely meaningless. I mentioned Bath and Body Works and Sun Ripened Raspberry. Some people were like country apple girlies.
I think there was a pear berry was
very yes.
Big.
Oh, is that yours?
No, I like the vanilla. There was a vanilla that came out only at the holidays.
These
that
are very
I used to
seared in our
on.
Core memories, clearly. So it's not as if we weren't also beauty or skincare girlies in our middle school years. It's just that the preponderance and the speed of the products being consumed and sold to our tweens of today is on a scale that we did not see in our youth. And what I'm excited about, so you asked if there's something good about it. I'm very happy to see the uptake of sunscreen.
Okay.
I think dermatologists all agree that if you're going to have one product that you put on your face, it should be sunscreen. They would probably vote for sunscreen before moisturizer in some cases. And so I love the fact that my daughter, without prompting, will put on sunscreen before she walks to school in the morning. That's pretty cool. I think if girls are wanting to take care of themselves in a way that means brushing your teeth twice a day and flossing and just general grooming. And, you know, there's plenty of kids who don't like to shower. And if this whole self-care trend means that you have clean kids, that's good, you know?
Yeah.
And I already mentioned the dark side of it, of course.
Right. Well, because like, I think just about I think you and I are around the same age. We grew up in a time where like women's bodies were talked about just horribly. Like when we go back and like we internalized all of that, and it was probably not great for our generation of young girls and women. And I think about like how, you know, you're talking about this like consumption of these products and the sameness and this desire for that. And I'm just like, I thought we were getting better and maybe we're not. And so it is like a little bit scary, but I also wonder if it's just like, that's what misogyny will do to you. Like, that's just like what capitalism will do to you, is like force you to feel like you could look better, be better, consume more.
Yeah, it problematizes things about our bodies so that we can buy things to fix them.
Right. Because like definitely babies need facials for sure. Like they have babies famously have terrible skin.
What
so like I don't know
discount.
Why nobody thought
yeah,
of this
before. Yeah, but what if you
before?
Get a discount on 4 facials in one? What if you get them in a pack? I'm just
so
kidding.
Crazy. Yes. So crazy. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we are back. I did not prep you for this part. This is, you have to just fucking figure it out. This is called Ask the Stacks. People email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com for a book recommendation or two or three. So I'm going to read you what this person said, and then we are going to give them recommendations.
Ooh, fun.
Yeah. Okay. This comes from Yolanda. And I have to say, because I know Yolanda's listening, I edited this down because she did a lot in the email, which she knew she did. And she was like, I did a lot. And so I've made choices. So this is edited.
Okay.
It says, I want to try one final time to get into audiobooks. I'm a huge fan of podcasts and don't know why I struggle with audiobooks. Could you recommend a few titles? Instead of asking for one genre, I'd like to try a few.
Oh my gosh.
In the original, she had given me four genres. I've narrowed it down to two. Because maybe certain genres work for me in audiobook format. So here's a sample of the two genres she's interested in. One is, I loved your episode with Ricardo Nuila about his book, The People's Hospital, and liked learning more about systemic issues, racism, misogyny, capitalism, imperialism, etc. And the other is memoirs. After listening to your episode with Chelsea Devantes, I almost bought my first celebrity memoir. It doesn't have to be a celebrity memoir. It could be something like Andrew Leland's Country of the Blind, but please no political memoirs, no to the Obamas. I think as memoirists, not as humans. They say, Tracy and guest, please help me get out of my reading rut with some great audiobook recommendations. Mm. I put together a little list, but I will let you go first in case anything popped into your head, or I will give you time to think while I go.
I don't have one for, I don't think I've listened to nonfiction as an audiobook. I almost always exclusively listen to fiction, contemporary fiction in audiobook format. So you go first on the nonfiction.
Okay. I almost exclusively listen to nonfiction on audiobook.
Perfect. We're yin and yang.
So here's what I will say. So for the first one, which is like episode or like audiobooks about systemic issues, I loved Tessa Miller's audiobook, What Doesn't Kill You. It's about chronic illness. She has Crohn's disease, and she talks about her experiences, but she also talks about like what it was like going through the medical system before they figured out that she had Crohn's disease. She had to have two fecal transplants. So she talks about like that whole process. It's funny. It's very touching. She just does a really great job reading the book. It feels like podcast. She feels like a person just talking and not like reading by rote. The other one, this is sort of a stretch, but I really liked it. And if you're struggling with audiobooks, I'm recommending it because it's essays and it has multiple narrators. Okay. It's called The Fight of the Century. It was edited by Ilett Waldman and Michael Chabon, and they're married in real life.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And yeah, they are. Isn't that crazy? And it is, it's an 100-year anniversary of the ACLU. And so each essay is written by like an amazing writer like Jesmyn Ward or like Britt Bennett or Yah Jesse or whatever. And it's about a different Supreme Court case. And they write about it in their own way. So like there's like one on Brown versus Board of Education and there's one on the Miranda rights, but there's also some on things you've never heard of. And it's narrated by the authors, but also like Samuel L. Jackson does one. Hey. And like, so it's just like a really enjoyable audio experience. Do you have any recommendations in that sort of systemic issues area?
Yes. And it's a little bit, it kind of overlaps with the topics that I'm interested in. Okay. It's called Plucked by Rebecca Herzig. Do you know this book, Tracy?
I don't know it, but I've heard of it.
Plucked is about the history of body hair.
Oh my gosh.
And body hair removal and just hair on our heads in general. And you would think that it would be kind of superficial, but it is tied into so many systems of power. It's tied into climate in really surprising ways and the use of resources. It's tied into not just gender and sexism, but also xenophobia and sort of religious intolerance. Because if you think about what we did to the detainees at Guantanamo in terms of making them shave their beards. And I remember thinking about this book as like, it's super fun too. So there is research, but it's like written in a way that moves very quickly. And I remember thinking about this book as like, oh my God, I don't think I can go 250 pages on body hair, but I could not put this down. I read it in a day.
Oh my gosh.
And it is exactly that kind of nonfiction book that is tied into so many bigger forces in the economy, in society, in culture, history. You'll love it.
That's amazing. I am a huge fan of like micro histories is what I call those books where it's like a deep dive into like one little thing. Like there's a book about parking that came out last year.
Yes.
Called
Paved Paradise. It. Yeah.
It's great. Like I'm just like, I didn't know I care, but it's great. Okay. And then for the memoirs, I went with two celebrity memoirs for you. One is Finding Me by Viola Davis. She could read me anything. Her voice is perfect. It's pretty dark. She had a pretty tough childhood, but it's really good. She's amazing. And then the other one, I'm cheating. This is my next audiobook read. I haven't read it yet, but my sister-in-law just read it. She texted me and she was like, it's amazing. And she does not read celebrity memoirs, but she said Rememberings by Sinead O'Connor. She said,
really?
It's fantastic. She said she learned so much about her. She didn't know a lot about her and it was really engaging. I think she said she listened to the whole thing in like a day or two. So I'm really excited about that. And then this is the third one. It's sort of a mix of the first of both kinds of books you want. And that is His Name is George Floyd. You guys have heard me talk about the book. It won the Pulitzer. I love the book. I didn't want to like it. I thought it was going to be like a money grab. It's so fantastic. It is like half biography, half social cultural history. I say that they gave George Floyd what I like to call the presidential treatment, which is where they went deep into his history. They treated him like he was, you know, Alexander Hamilton, famously not a president who got a presidential treatment book.
Yes.
It's like that. So that would be mine. Do you have any celebrity memoirs that you think are great?
Does the founder of Patagonia count as a celebrity?
Yeah.
Then I'm going to recommend the memoir by Yvonne Chouinard, who is the founder of Patagonia, and it's called Let My People Go Surfing. I was in this book club with a good friend of mine in which we could not veto each other's choices.
And it's just he decided, the two of you?
Yes. And he decided to, it was going on for years, and he decided to choose this book for us, as well as another one that really stands out to me as something I would never choose was like A History of Mongolia, but it ended up being very good. Anyway, so Let My People Go Surfing is the story of Yvonne Chouinard's life. It turns out he's like a big climber, a big outdoorsman, and then the founding of Patagonia and all the values that are imbued in the founding of this company. And even though I am not some big CEO or anything, some of the real cultural business practices that he talked about and just the way that he considers himself kind of a steward of the earth and then treats his people, like the people around him and the people that work for him as people who like are with a certain humanity and deserving of care. I really loved that. And it was just surprising to me as a great
memoir. The other celebrity memoir that's obvious that I've been listening to because of the audio experience alone is Britney's, of course.
Amazing. It's so good. And it's so short.
Yeah. It didn't seem like it took a lot of time, but
no, it's amazing. It's one of the best celebrity memoirs I've ever read.
Right.
Okay. So Yolanda, let us know if you read any of those, if we made it so that you can read audiobooks, or if we failed you, let us know either way. And everyone else, email askthestacks@thestackspodcast.com to get your recommendation on the air. I'm always in need of these, so don't be shy. We'll help you. Okay, Elise, two books you love, one book you hate.
Two books that I love, one book that I can never stop talking about is 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman. It is called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals.
Okay.
And it bills itself as a time management book, kind of, but it really isn't. It ends up getting into Jungian philosophy and Buddhism, and it really underlines why it's important to be selective about how we spend our time. Mm. And it really helped me with my hedonistic tendencies, because I tend to want to do everything and eat everything and try everything. And reading this book really changed the way I think in a lot of ways, and my personal philosophy. So 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. One book that is really on my mind that I want to recommend to everybody, which most Stacks listeners have probably already listened to or read, is Girlhood by Melissa Phoebos.
I've never read it. I haven't.
It's a collection of essays, and it's not her most recent book, but it's beautifully written, and it considers a lot of the questions that we have about womanhood and then our bodies and what sort of belongs to us and how sort of we end up divorcing kind of ourselves from our bodies as we get older and go through adolescence and kind of have to find ourselves again. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of things, a lot of the stuff that I reckon with as somebody who is now 40. And so Girlhood by Melissa Phoebos is another one that I love. One that I did not love.
Okay.
That I read in the last few years, and I just remember this really standing out in my mind, was the modern take on Anna Karenina called Hausfrau.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah, you don't need to.
No.
You don't need to. I was really excited about it because I was like, ooh, a modern twist. Because usually I like adaptations. There's been so many adaptations of Pride and Prejudice, for example, and I'm just there for it. I'm always like, oh, great. But Hausfrau was not it.
Did you read Anna Kay? Mm-mm. Okay, that's an adaptation of Anna Karenina that I fucking love.
Okay,
it is
great.
So good. Actually, it ties into Flawless because it goes to Korea. It centers a Korean-American girl as Anna Kay, and it's like Gossip Girl meets Anna Karenina. They're like rich kids in New York City. I can't remember if it's in the first one or the second one, because there is a sequel where she goes to Korea and like meets like a K-pop star that she like flirts with or whatever. So anyways, it's so much fun. If you like Gossip Girl, if you like teens having sex, like, it's for you.
if you're into teens doing drugs. Hey, I'm sex positive. That's awesome.
I love a teen having sex. Having sex, ideally, I guess, but not actually. I don't like to watch or anything like that. Just, this is getting dark. I love Gossip Girls, what I'm trying to say. Anyways, Anna Kay's really fun. It's YA.
I assume nobody throws themselves in front of a train.
Well, you'll have to read and see.
Okay.
You'll have to wait and see.
No spoilers.
Okay. I'm hearing from you that you read a lot of fiction and a lot of nonfiction.
Yeah.
Are there any genres that you are not into or that you avoid? Or any fantasy. Favorite genres?
Fantasy. I don't really read fantasy. You get dragons in there and I'm like, tapping out.
Okay.
Tapping out.
And what's your like go-to?
Usually contemporary fiction. So like the Celeste Ings of the world.
Okay.
Kazuo Ishiguro's.
Okay.
I just read You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty, which I know is one of your favorites.
We did with Sam Sanders.
Did
book
you?
Club.
Okay. Yes,
he
that's
was
right.
The good book club guest for that one.
Sam recommended it to me.
Oh, which of course he did. Right. You know it's what, like, Sam? Stop trying to steal my thunder. I recommended it to Sam.
Oh, really?
So, in your face, Sam.
I like romance. I like YA.
Okay.
Mary H.K. Choi is one of my favorite authors. Ugh.
Love. Love Mary. Love Mary. You'll like Anna Kay. You'll like Anna
Kay. Okay. I can't wait.
What's the last just great book you read?
True Biz.
Oh, we did that on book club. I feel like you should be in the book club. I feel like You're going to like it here. You're
yeah,
here.
I got to get out of my one book club.
Yeah, I had a book club with one friend. I had a book club with one friend for a long time. And then the next book club I did was this podcast. Yeah. So I joke because I'm like, I've never been in a book club where I've had to let anybody else make any choices. I am a book club dictator and that's it for me. But yes, we did True Biz. True Biz is good.
I still think about True Biz a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you reading right now?
I'm reading Interior Chinatown.
Hey, that's our book club pick this month.
And it's all in courier font.
Yeah, I know.
Do you want to say why it's all in courier font?
Because it's a script.
Yes, it's written as a screenplay.
Yeah, I'm
really
excited.
Which is really awesome. Yeah, I am trying my hand at screenplay writing myself. And so I am writing in courier font as well. And this is why it's such a great book club choice. Sometimes a book just meets the moment you're in your life, and Interior Chinatown is it for me. So thank you.
I'm so excited. We're going to discuss that the last Wednesday of the month, everyone. So read up, meet us back here. Elise will be back to do that. Okay. How do you pick what you read next when I don't tell you to read Interior Chinatown?
Sam Sanders.
Okay. Well, spoiler alert, I guess you're getting some recs from me because I definitely rec to Sam a lot. But he does rec back to me.
No, the answer is I have a few friends that I trust that also love reading as much as me. And then we will talk to each other and text with each other every once in a while when we're like really moved by something. There was a book last year that I read called Mad Honey that I would not have read. Mm. But for my mom friend, that's like, you've got to listen to Mad Honey as an audiobook because it's read by one of my favorite audiobook narrators. And so I listened to Mad Honey at her recommendation. I'm also still a working journalist, so I get a lot of galleys sent to me, and don't stop sending them, publicists, because I find a lot of books just because they were mailed to my house, and I'm like, oh, catastrophe ethics. Interesting.
Right.
So that's on my shelf right now.
How much reading do you do for work itself as opposed to for pleasure?
Mostly for pleasure. So okay. I think that I only read about 20 to 40% for at 40% on a really busy year. Okay. And usually when I read for work, it tends to be nonfiction because I sometimes fill in for Life Kit, which ends up being, you know, a lot right. of like how to optimize your life kind
right,
of books.
Right, right, right. They let me come on that show and talk about how to pick a book. And I was
yes.
so excited.
I listened to that episode.
I was like,
you were
thank
awesome.
You so much. Yeah. I was like, I don't know that I am a person for this show because
are
I
you
listen
kidding
to the
me?
Show.
Yeah. How much do you read, Tracy? Can I interview you?
Yeah. I read a lot.
Yeah. So like last year, let's say
142 books.
Holy.
I finished 142 books.
Do you consider yourself a fast reader?
No, I'm not a fast reader. It's my biggest downfall.
How do you get through it?
Well, it's my job. So I set aside time. Like this mm-hmm. morning after I dropped my kids off for work, mm-hmm. I sat down and I read for like a little bit over an hour to finish the last 40 pages of the book I was reading. So okay. To me, a fast reader is like a page a minute or faster. Mm-hmm. I am definitely in the slower category.
Well, you want to take it in too.
Yeah, I want to take it in, but sometimes I don't. Sometimes I wish I could just read faster to be done because I'm like done with the book. I figured it out. I'm done. I just want to know so I can talk about it later.
How do you decide when to quit a book?
It depends on why I'm reading the book. So if I'm reading the book for the podcast, I don't quit. Mm. I think there have been two books, and I will never name them, that I did not finish before I interviewed the author. Okay. And I'm on episode 300 and something at this point. So that's a lot of books to finish. But if it's for pleasure or just like for fun to check something out, I'll finish. I'll quit 10 pages in. If it's not grabbing me, there's just too much for me to read to like really try to force myself. So I'll quit pretty early.
Okay. Yeah. I remember asking my editor about this because she has to read so many submissions and she says she gives fiction at least 50 pages.
Yeah.
She's but like, I've given you 50 pages.
Sometimes I'll quit so early because I'm like, the writing is bad and I don't care about the topic enough. Like sometimes I'll be like, oh, maybe I'm interested in socks. And then the writing is so bad. I'm like, I'm not interested in socks. I don't care. I can't do 50 pages of this.
You
so
will
bad.
Be quickly engrossed in body hair removal, though.
I am interested in that for some Pluck reason.
By Rebecca Herzig.
I can't wait. Okay, wait. Back to you. This was a trick. This is a journalist.
I'm just
trick.
More comfortable asking the questions.
I know how that is, but you're here for me to do this, okay? What's the book that you think that you recommend to people the most or you love recommending to people?
Oh, that's the one I gave you.
The 4,000
Yeah, it's 4,000 weeks. I know it sounds like I'm recommending a business bro book. It is not.
I've heard it's great. I've also heard it's horrible. And I think it just depends on
where you're at,
who you are and where you're at. But I have heard fantastic things about that book, specifically from like people our age
in midlife
who are parents.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's another book that I've been recommending at post turning 40. It's called The Middle Passage by James Hollis. It looks like self-published. It might have been in the 1970s or something. But this was recommended to me by the showrunner of Mad Men, Matt Weiner, who said that reading this, which is based in Jungian philosophy, and Freud, was really informed his thinking in developing the characters on that show. And The Middle Passage is about this kind of time in our lives, which some people are describing as a vortex, I think, and apparently a lot of women are going through, like Natalie Portman, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of women who are famously getting divorced, like the Cup of Joe, Joanna Goodard. And so anyway, it's very kind of woo in some places and academic and even hard to read.
Okay.
But if you can extrapolate the ideas out of it, there's so many times where I'm like, oh yeah, that tracks. Okay. That tracks. Okay. So The Middle Passage is another one. Oh, another pop culture reference. This was in a scene of Ted Lasso. It was like on somebody's table. And it was the middle. It was like this cover of The Middle Passage that I'm holding up for Tracy right now.
That's it's such wild. An ugly
cover, I think that
too.
It has some sort of influence, maybe in people for people who write some of our big cultural
interesting
exports. Yeah.
Do you have an ideal reading setup?
Food, I love
snacks, beverages, location, anything like that.
Yeah, I like a lightly sweet iced tea.
Okay.
Or boba, but usually at home I have a lightly sweet iced tea, so I won't do any of that Gold Peak stuff.
Okay. Do you brew at home or you buy a...
I'll either brew at home and then add simple syrup, or I will buy a kind of iced tea, a bottled iced tea that's ridiculously overpriced, and then I get it shipped to my house in 12 packs. But I really survived on that during the writing of the book.
Okay.
I also like to read in transit a lot. Mm. So I really miss public transit. I spent a lot of time reading on subways and on buses when I lived abroad. And even now when I travel, that's something I really enjoy.
Me too. That's part of the origin story of this podcast is I used to read a lot. And then when I moved to LA, I stopped reading. And so I was like, I'm going to start reading again.
And then I'm going to overachieve and read 150 books a year.
Then I'm going to become a person who has a problem and needs help. do you have a favorite bookstore?
Here in LA, I go to Village Well. That's local bookstore. Oh, it's awesome.
Oh, that's the new one in Culver?
It's in Culver on the main drag in Culver on Culver Boulevard. And Jennifer, who runs the store, is just an awesome curator. And she has events like almost every night. And it has become it used to be like a vegan burger shop and nobody went. And now it's become such a place for community. And you can just go and hang out. It's one of those bookstores where you can go and no capitalistic exchange is required. You can just go and hang out and read and discover. And I love that. I like bringing my kids there too.
I gotta go. I was supposed to go with a friend and then it just never happened. Now I gotta go. Now I gotta go.
Obviously, okay. Skylight is awesome. North Fig is awesome. There's great books.
There's so many great bookstores here. What's the last book you purchased? Do you remember?
Yeah, I just did. I just purchased Hunt, Gather, Parent by my NPR colleague, Michaeline Duclef.
I really like that book.
Yes, because I am in development on some documentary ideas and thought maybe... that the notion of us in the West and in the US being the weird perspective and everybody else being kind of like a better perspective, I love.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to think of projects that might be able to be based in that lens.
I really like that book. It really helped me when my kids were very small, which is when I read it. And now sometimes I catch myself doing things that she's like, definitely don't do that in the book and being like, well, too bad for me, I guess. Sorry, I live in America. I'm going to remind my kid 15 times to put his shoes on. What's the last book that made you laugh?
Not counting Britney Spears, The Woman in Me.
Oh. Well, okay, I guess.
There were parts of that.
Yes, there were for shiz is right, the audio moment.
Yeah. The audio book part of that made me laugh at Justin Timberlake in particular. Unintentionally, one book that made me laugh that like maybe wasn't trying to make me laugh in its absurdity was Disorientation.
Oh yeah.
By Elaine Shea Cho.
Yeah.
And that's a take of kind of a takedown of academia.
I loved that book.
And Yellow Fever, yeah. which is Asian fetish. And right. It made me laugh a lot, actually.
Yeah, it's very funny. What's the last book that made you cry?
Cry. Crying in H Mart.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What about the last book that made you angry?
This is actually a cousin of Disorientation. Yellow Face?
Yes. Okay. Why did Yellow
Face made me super angry about the publishing industry. And it helped me see things about the publishing industry that I didn't realize. I didn't know that the publishing industry essentially chooses winners and losers before books even come out, which means that like if you are a debut author, you don't really know. You're left to the whims of these deciders. And so you can't really do anything about these larger forces that are out of your control. I didn't realize that. And that made me kind of mad.
Yeah. I mean, that would make me mad.
There's too much gatekeeping.
So much in publishing. Some of it is really intentional. And I think some of it is because people who work in publishing don't always know about like culture, unfortunately. What about a book where you felt like you learned a lot?
Besides Plucked by Rebecca Hertzig?
Yeah.
I'm a one man Rebecca Hertzig stan.
Yeah.
Yes. The book that I learned from a lot and that I'm now applying in my life is a book called The Nutshell Method, which is one of the thousands of books on screenwriting. Because Flawless got optioned and I got the privilege of writing the treatment for a feature film. And I have no background in screenwriting whatsoever. And I was really starting from scratch. And somebody told me to read The Nutshell Method by Jill Chamberlain. And she's a script doctor. And she kind of breaks things down for you and talks about structure in a way that was really eye-opening. And I think that I could reverse engineer and apply to journalism too. Like, I wish I knew about this method and the importance of this kind of structure and where to put things and trying to map them out in advance. Mm-hmm. I wish I knew about this 10, 20 years ago as a fledgling journalist.
I love that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Okay. If you were a high school teacher, what's the book you would assign in class?
I'm trying to think a book that I was assigned that, I hope it's still assigned in this age of book bans. Ellison, The Invisible Man.
Oh, I'm sure it's assigned some places and definitely not assigned other places.
Yeah, that I was like, yes, I remember reading that in high school and having a lot of questions and that and what else kind of opened up a lot of questions for me? Oh, I would assign like essays, you know, like journalistic essays. Mm-hmm. David Foster Wallace has a great collection called Consider the Lobster. That's one of my favorite books. And I wish I would have read that earlier in my life. Mm. His journalism, I prefer to his novels.
Yeah.
So that collection. But then something I keep near me. Let me see if I have it near me. Joan Didion has a book called Political Fictions. That's really very good. And another book that I wish I had read earlier in my life and before I became civically minded and could vote. And the other is this tiny, is this like a booklet? It's not even called a book.
It's just one of her speeches, right?
Yes. And I keep this with me because anytime I'm feeling like, I don't know, as I talked about at the very beginning of the interview, I often felt like my place in life had to be earned, you know? And I think that I really reckon with that now that I'm older and I live in a more diverse place. But I grew up in this place that was very heavily Caucasian persuasion.
Right.
And I remember reading Audre Lorde and this particular speech, I'm holding up the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Mm-hmm. And there were parts of it where I was just like, oh my gosh, I am worthy and I matter and I don't have to do anything different or have to be perfect in order to earn my place. And in fact, the reason why I feel the way I do and that I have to sort of earn my worthiness is the product of a structural isms, all sorts of different intersectional isms. And so I wish I would have had it. You know, I wish the younger me would have had it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that speech, if you have Sister Outsider, that speech is in Sister Outsider also, because that's like a compilation of a bunch of her speeches. Mm. Okay, last one. I know we're over time. Sorry. I stole it from the New York Times. Buy the book. If you could require the current president of the United States of America to read one book, what would it be?
Do we know whether Joe Biden is a reader? Like, we knew that.
I don't know. I don't know.
We knew that Obama was a big reader, and I felt like and then we know that Donald Trump never reads
anything. I think he's probably somewhere between the two, is my sense.
Yeah. I would love for him to read something about the way, you know what I would actually, I hope that he reads this because it's just out and I feel like it's really relevant to this misinformation and tech-addled time that we live in now, which is Kara Swisher's new book, Burn Book. Mm-hmm. And it's a memoir. And maybe some people are critiquing it as like self-aggrandizing of Kara Swisher. Okay. But she also lays out the unique moment that we're in when it comes to the collapse of media and a subsequent or parallel collapse of democracy.
Interesting.
And so I could recommend, of course I could recommend like some sort of high-minded Clash of Civilizations type nonfiction.
Right.
But I actually think that for this particular president, he should be more hip on what's happening in media.
Yeah.
He should be more hip. Misinformation.
Like, period.
Yeah.
actually, that's a really good recommendation. Okay, everybody. We're out of here. This is what you need to know from me. One, Flawless. It's out in the world. You can get it wherever you get your books. You can also get the audiobook. Elise reads it. I listened to some. I read some. Highly recommend the audiobook. I had a great time with it.
Oh, yeah.
Two, we are going to be back, Elise and I, discussing Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu on March 27th. That is the last Wednesday of this month. There will be spoilers, so read the book. Read some Courier font. Enjoy your time in the screenwriting world. And that is it for housekeeping. Thank you so much for being here, Elise.
This was so much fun. And you really stumped me on a lot of things, but it required really being thoughtful. And I love it. So thanks for the assignment.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you all so much for listening. And thank you again to Elise Hugh for joining the show. I'd also like to thank Alana Nevins for helping to make this conversation possible. Don't forget, Elise will be back on March 27th to discuss the Stacks Book Club pick, Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head to patreon.com/thestacks and join the Stacks Pack. Make sure you subscribe to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.